Kaya Cater is about to release the album Grenades, and she joins me now. Kaya, hello.
Hey, Craig.
Nice to meet you.
Good to meet you, too.
Heard so much wonderful stuff about your music in addition to enjoying your music over the last year or two, and it's been a really wonderful time for you. You've seen your music rise in profile and be noticed and praised, and that's got to feel good. Can you summarize that and what it means, you know, just what it means to you?
It feels good. I mean, I think ever since I graduated college in 2016, so 2 years ago now, I just wanted to be able to make a living with music, and I'm happy to be able to do that, you know, and also to be able to grow. You know, I just took up the acoustic guitar, which is really fun, and yeah, to be back at Americana is nice, and talking to you.
I noticed you were playing the acoustic on the single you released today, which we'll talk about in a second. But the banjo is clearly where I wanted to start because talk about an instrument with history and with baggage and with beauty and with it's manifested itself in so many ways. Your folks were into folk music, so you probably got an inkling of not just that it was sounded cool, but where it had been. What it represented, what you could do with it. So I'd love to hear you just open-ended your story of the banjo and what attracted you to it.
Sure. My grandfather is a luthier, so he built harpsichords and later acoustic guitars, and he actually has I think he holds the record for the longest harpsichord ever built or something. His name is Wolfgang Cater, which is like, it's like a weird record to have held in your family, but... anyway, he started making acoustic guitars for free and giving them away to artists that he really enjoyed. Yeah. He would see somebody play like Penny Lang or a few other artists in and around Quebec, which is where my family's from. And I think he built Penny Lang like a beautiful archtop guitar. I grew up knowing folk musicians. Not only playing folk music with my family at jams and stuff, but really just knowing musicians. So it never seemed, folk music never seemed that foreign to me. Yeah. I started playing the banjo. I was kind of inexplicably attracted to it. You know, I heard an interview with Justin Robinson, formerly of the Carolina Chocolate Drops, and the way he explained it was just that he loves the tone. It just sounds so peaceful and meditative, and I was playing other instruments at the time, but that was just one that stuck. And I had a teacher, and I went to a few camps in the American South, and I just kind of kept going.
Of course, the tone of a clawhammer banjo with a natural skin is quite a different thing than the Earl Scruggs banjo with the resonator and the metal finger picks, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So you were drawn to, and I love that clawhammer, and I grew up in North Carolina, and one day I'm going to learn how. I'm very jealous when I hear it.
There's still time.
Yeah,
man.
There is. Yeah. The technique's so cool. What? Give us a little insight into the way you wanted to play the instrument.
Sure. So I actually started playing on like Scruggs style banjo.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. And that didn't stick for long. I think once I heard old time music, I was like, well, to hell with the bluegrass stuff. I also feel like maybe on a visceral level, old time music and people who played old time music were more readily accessible to me. Like at folk festivals in Canada, the definition of folk music there is closer to what I would say like maybe world music would be. Mm-hmm. So at a lot of festivals there was everything from old time to Cajun to sometimes West African music to singer-songwriters to whatever else. And that's how I first started hearing old time music, like through Riley Bogus and Dirk Powell. They had a duo set, and I remember that was some of the first stuff I heard. The clawhammer banjo, I would say, is an older style of playing. It's very mm-hmm. percussive.
Yeah.
to any listeners who are curious about it. You hit the string with your nail rather than plucking up like finger picking or Travis picking would be on a guitar. And it's kind of messy and muddy and and complicated, but apparently that style has roots in West Africa as well, as does the banjo. So it's kind of this, yeah, this very ancient way of playing the banjo, and it most often lends itself to singing as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, how central was the Carolina Chocolate Drops to you embracing a string band sound and feel that prior to them had laid so low? And what I kind of got feedback, and I was interested in these questions quite a long time ago, I'm certainly no expert, but somebody did point out to me at one point that the dearth of African Americans and people of color in bluegrass especially, and even in blues, when you know your finger style, I'd be like, well, there's Roy Bookbinder, I can take his video, or these all these white guys playing music that came from Blind Blake and Elizabeth Cotton. But somebody made the point that there was just a lot of imagery and a lot of, that was attached to just history, that young African Americans were not really ready to say, I'm going to walk through all of the baggage or the shame or the imagery that has been attached to this and be that person that sparks some renovation, revolution, reinvention of this thing. But the Carolina Chocolate Drops clearly did, and Rhiannon Giddens has taken that to many levels, social commentary, theater, all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And so they cast a big shadow, or a big light, maybe is the better word, on this set of choices you had growing up. So take me into that world with you.
Yeah, you know, I started playing probably before that snap to consciousness that the folk music scene was privy to with the arrival of the Carolina Chocolate Drops. I did have, shame is a good word, I had a lot of shame associated with playing this instrument that, you know, not only was I not Appalachian, which in my mind and in my personal view, that was a strike, you know, strike one against me was that I wasn't Appalachian, and then strike two against me was that I wasn't white, and so I felt like, you know, I wasn't, and still am not white. I kept it to myself, and really what I say about that tone, it is something that was almost the only thing keeping me playing for a long time, was trying to ignore all that history, I think, because I didn't have the mental capacity or the emotional bandwidth to really wrestle with that, or even the emotional language, which I think is something that the Carolina Chocolate Drops, just by, you know, never mind their prowess in bringing black string band music, and especially music from the Piedmont area, to light, but just by their physical bodies being on stage playing music, you know, to me, I saw them when I was at Folk Alliance. I was maybe 13 or 14. And I still remember just the buzz of people freaking out. Like, people were freaking out about how truly crazy it was to see three black Americans who were in their early 20s play this music that not only was considered to be, you know, backwards by a lot of people, by a lot of you know, northern people and everything, but also considered to be white. So that was an interesting revelation for me, and I think the beginning of sort of giving myself permission to like the music that I like. And that's, you know, that's an ongoing thing. I think I just turned 25, and I feel like every year it gets more and more comfortable in it. It gets the lines that I've drawn for myself are erased a little bit more, you know.
You refer to the American South, as one would if we call it the South. What, and I'm always curious, of all folk singers and folk musicians who are from Canada and even from the Northeast, I'm from North Carolina, which is South, but kind of on the border, not deep South. And I remember my first pilgrimage to try to go see places like Clarksdale, Mississippi, or Opelousas, Louisiana, mm-hmm. and to be in New Orleans, and to really see, after becoming a new fan and lover of roots music, this vast place, and a place that had just an unbelievable history, almost indescribable history, you know, unimaginable history in some ways. What did it look like to you from a distance, and what sort of fascinations, and when were you able to start to touch it actually, and what were the voices that came out of the South that made you go, I gotta go there?
Sure, yeah. Almost in a reverential way, I was so obsessed with the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou soundtrack.
Oh, yeah, great.
And, you know, that whole movie that, you know, the Coen brothers are obviously great filmmakers and you know, did their homework in terms of getting good music on that movie. And I was taken to the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou tour in 2002, in August of 2002. And I remember that concert. I think it was just after John Hartford had died, or he had left the tour prior to that. So unfortunately, I didn't really get to know him or his music until a bit later. But I remember seeing Gillian and Emmylou and got a bunch of other people, Dan Tominski. And it just had this synthesis to me of just, it had a lot of guts, and it had a lot of, and a lot of groove.
Yeah.
And
story.
And, you know, I mean, I love folk music, but also there's something about traditional music that is so impressive to me, and so cool, and so great. And so that was my first sort of like, wow, okay, this is what this is. And then years later, I went to a banjo camp in outside of Asheville, North Carolina.
Oh yeah.
At Warren Wilson College, and was able to study the old time Clawhammer banjo, and that was another. It was just so cool to get out of my life in Canada and to go, like, what do the Blue Ridge Mountains look like to a 14-year-old that's only ever seen, you know, what she knows, which is, you know, city and the Gatineau Hills, which are definitely dwarfed by the Blue Ridge Mountains. So, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it, like I've said, a lot of it was visceral. And I just knew what I liked, and I just kind of followed that. I like this. Okay, what else do I like? I like this. Okay, get me closer to what I like, kind of thing.
You also spent time in West Virginia. What was that about?
I got out of high school. I was supposed to go study international relations, and, you know, I was accepted to the program, and then I just didn't want to go, so I dropped out and moved to Montreal, back to Montreal. I had been going to high school in Winnipeg, and I worked for a year, and like that camp in Asheville, the Swannanoa Gathering, there's also a camp in Elkins, West Virginia, on the campus of Davis and Elkins College, and the camp is called the Augusta Heritage Center. And so I was waitressing, and I applied there for a scholarship to continue my, you know, kind of fractured education of, like, going down for these intensives and then coming back up. And it turns out that behind the scenes, the college had been kind of rallying the Augusta Heritage Center to try and recruit young musicians who were, you know, rather advanced in their instruments. Mm-hmm. And to get a string band together as well as a dance collective. And together we would represent, be sort of like a cultural export of the school. So be able to go to other schools or other communities and, you know, wear the name of the school and present Appalachian music, and specifically West Virginia music and West Virginian songs and dances and stuff like that.
You're here at Americana Fest. In general, as you look at the span of what's presented here and what counts as Americana in the press and radio and festivals especially, how are you feeling about how old-time music and folk, as you know it, is represented?
I think folk and old-time music, and I'm going to lump them together with one overlying characteristic, which is a connotation of the past. I think this conference is and has to be, maybe by their own volition, very forward-leaning and forward-thinking. And I think that brings about a lot of clashes in terms of what genres of music are, you know, are considered to be part of the Americana umbrella and which genres of music are not. The struggle that I've had sometimes with old time and folk music is that it's been considered, sometimes rightly so, to not be forward-looking enough and to be a little passé, a little bit, maybe sometimes even a little bit kitschy, something that's quaint, but that does not quite have the artistic merit that maybe a larger band with more people and more, like, volume does. You know, I don't know. I struggle with that internally because I play old-time music and I play folk music, and I constantly am thinking about how to make it relevant to me, how to make it primarily, and in that way make it relevant to other young people. But I don't know. I mean, I think it's a conversation of, you know, does old-time music, especially old-time music, fit under this banner? And will we keep it? And if we keep it, then why? You know, I think that it deserves to be here in the same way that blues music deserves to be here. There's been a multi-decade long conversation of what Americana is going to be. And it's a very, in my opinion, it's a very nascent genre or umbrella. And I think it's worth it to the Americana Association and other associations to not exactly lock anything out right now.
You've just released a single advancing your new record, and on this single is an electric guitar and drum and steel pedal steel, and you strum the acoustic guitar and doing more of a singer-songwriter thing with a band. So does that, I don't know what Grenades the album is going to feel like, if it's a mixture, but it's clearly a bit of a, this song indicates a little bit of a change. And so address that if you would.
Yeah, sure. I'm trying to keep my music interesting to me, sure. As I said before. There was a certain part of me that just wanted to rock out with a band. I think a lot of singer-songwriters or people that come from kind of quieter music or just have that, you know, Beyonce has that Sasha Fierce, her alter ego is Sasha Fierce. And I feel a lot like, okay, yeah, in front of a drum kit, I'm like something else, or I'm showing another dimension of myself, maybe my Sasha Fierce. But, you know, the whole, it's maybe half that, and a lot of stuff, you know, I have a song that I do strictly with upright bass and banjo, and a few songs that I sing a cappella. I have a song that's calypso influenced. I mean, I don't know. I definitely think there was a marked change, you know, from my exit from West Virginia and my re-entrance into Canada. My influence has changed because the people that I was around were different. And so there's a difference there, and there's a change there. And I think that I carry the influences of Appalachian music with me, and I'm always down to play tunes, and I will always be that way. But it's almost like I need to push my own limits and see where else I can go before I come back home. And so it kind of feels like a bit of a, what the Amish call it, a rumspringa of like when you go out into the world, try out different things. And Grenades feels a little experimental that way, you know, a bit like, okay, how much can my songs hold? How strong is my songwriting? What is too far? You know, can I write a song on, you know, Whirly and release that? Sure. I mean, that's what the Grenades, the actual single, is on Wurlitzer. So yeah,
good. I ain't holding you back.
giving you an answer of a 25-year-old, I think is the.
Your songwriting is fascinating. It is, I would put it on the poetry side because you don't leave clear breadcrumb trails. You use language, you use imagery, you use some spectral kinds of quality, and there's so I find myself with the new Colossus, this song you dropped yesterday, I'm like, I want to see the lyrics because I'm not sure I'm getting every word, and I want to feel what those words are because there's a lot going on in there, tactily in your mouth, and in there's beautiful language, but also it's a tough ass song, and it seems like it's about some scary stuff. How would you introduce it to people? What's the liner notes so that people can hear it with a little bit of insight?
Sure. So the first verse is, "New Colossus teaches us the sacred math, stalks the limits of my living room and cuts me clean in half. Oh, time, the minute hand spins me round the plane, spins the big machine as it descends again." So it's based off of a poem by Emma Lazarus, which was actually placed, it's the one that was placed under the Statue of Liberty. So if you go and visit the statue, you'll see that poem, and it's called The New Colossus. Oh. And the original Colossus, the old Colossus, was a large statue that was said to be, you know, like 20 or 30 feet high, above a Grecian city, and I can't remember which city, but
Rhodes.
Rhodes, the city of Rhodes.
And I'm not sure 20-30 stories, like it was supposed to stride across the entrance to a harbor, I think.
Right, yes.
So we're talking about
maybe
a giant.
I'm minimizing
this, the colossal. That would be very colossal.
Yes, thank you for filling that in.
I'm not great in the classics. That's one wee bit I remember.
And you know, the poem of the new Colossus is the one from which, you know, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, and those yearning to be free, or from the teeming shores." Yeah. You know, really evocative, and I love that it's a woman, a giant woman, and to me, women are, especially in my life, you know, when I was a child, I felt like I was constantly surreptitiously being encouraged to shrink, maybe being discouraged. Mm. And I kind of shrunk, and I'd have these physical postures where I'd be smaller. I'd have these ideas and these opinions, but I wouldn't say them. Mm. And it was really this kind of self-effacing, self-annihilating state. And the interesting thing about the new Colossus is, you know, not only the statue, but the poem is big and it's broad. And I think especially, you know, I don't want to make it a political song because I think that limits it a little bit. It's more than that. But I think it's just a song to me that encompasses the anger and just this kind of ferocious presence that I feel that women can have, and especially reflected in that statue.
Mm, interesting. That'll mm-hmm. help me listen again. And,
yeah.
And the video of you singing it does not look like a person with a head full of bliss and a heart full of charity. So,
<No. laughs>
and we won't get into the full album, but I do want to notice that the title Grenades, in addition to being loaded, you are Canadian. And I don't know if anybody's caught on to the pun yet, but that's a masterful little gesture.
Thank you. I think you're the first one. Yes, kudos. Yes, that's right. It is a play on the word Grenada.
Yeah.
I wrote a lot of the album in April when I went home to my dad's home country of Grenada, yeah. Which for listeners is in the southern part of the Antilles, the Lesser Antilles, right off the coast of Venezuela. And I wrote a lot about family history, which again is obviously, as my songwriting pattern shows, a little bit shrouded, not very clear cut, but I think you can hear it if you listen to it. And you know, I also wrote an accompanying essay to go with the album, and it's coming out on Smithsonian Folkways, who very aptly have a history of supporting the story, not only the commercial side. So that will be released as well to give listeners more of an idea of what the record stands for and.
Well, tomorrow I'm going to meet John Smith from Smithsonian Folkways. I wanted to seek him out because I realized that Smithsonian Folkways was signing contemporary artists, indeed young artists like yourself, and that's really exciting to add to the legacy with people who are doing meaningful work now. What does it mean to you to be on that label?
Means a lot. They're working hard, and it's a very, what I liked was that it was a very conscious decision, we could remain an archival label, or, we could essentially, what they're doing is taking gambles on young artists. Not that I'm that much of a gamble. I think I'm a pretty sure thing. But, and they're also signing a lot of women. I like that,
I think Anna and Elizabeth are going to be one of the ways in which people feel a very legacy vibe while getting and see and feel some deep tradition and have it be presented utterly as an utterly contemporary work of art that is so potent and going to be a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
This has gone on longer than I thought it would in the best possible way. I'll tell you what, I'll save any other questions I have for the next time, because
okay.
I know there will be.
Sure.
I'm thrilled to meet you, and I'm thrilled to see the reaction to what you're doing, and look forward to more music. So Kaya Cater, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Craig.